History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our series, Key Battles of World War I. In the previous episode, we were looking at the Western Front with the failed German Spring Offensive. We're now at Key Battle 12 of the series, and I guess we started with Key Battle 10, but it just grew into something bigger, huh, James?
Yeah, we just couldn't quite keep it down to 10.
You know, I think it's in the spirit of World War I, it's appropriate, where you begin with something you think will be one thing, but then it just keeps growing and growing and growing. It doesn't stop, and it metastasizes into something much bigger. So
absolutely. I mean, we could have made it 15 or 20. There's just, as we've seen, just constant fighting. It's hard to sometimes to declare when one battle's over and the next one starts.
We call it a battle, but it's more of a campaign, and each individual campaign is actually bigger than entire wars that are fought. So is there a word that's bigger than war that we can use to apply to World War I?
Catastrophe.
Super war.
I don't know.
It's something beyond that. So that's what we're trying to do here. We have the 100 Days Offensives to describe this battle, although it's much more than a battle. So where we left off, Germany realized in the previous battle, I'm talking about the Spring Offensives, that the only way to win was to push into France before the United States fully deployed the resources. And it failed. They were stopped. So that means just the war is over and it's just mop-up operations from here on out, right? I mean, just, you know, easy fall and that's going to be it. I think it's...
Yeah, Germany's just going to say, oh, well, you know, we blew it, so we give up.
Now, like, on the face of it, of course, that's not the case. It's not going to be easy to win. But behind the scenes, things are even more precarious than people realized at the time. Historians have dug in and looked at the situation of the French and British, and they were still holding their resolve. Well, the French, maybe not so much because they've really borne the brunt of it for years, but the British are trying to hold it together and keep a stiff upper lip, but they are barely hanging in there in 1918. By the year end 1917, just to give you some context, France had lost 3 million men in the war. Britain had lost 2 million men. The French army mutinied in 1917. A lot of its army was demoralized and they were refusing to attack the Germans. And the British weren't that much better off. They had lost 800,000 casualties in 1917. It climaxed with a 3-month assault in the heights of Passchendaele, where 300,000 infantry fell to gain 2 miles of ground. And by 1918, it was a state secret of the number of French reserves of military age recruits that they still had because so few of them were still left alive. France maintained its 110 divisions in 1918, but they weren't doing this by infusing them with new manpower because there was none, but by reducing the number of regiments in a French division from 4 to 3. The British barely maintained their 62 divisions in the Western Front. And in the course of 1918, had the Americans not arrived, they would have had to reduce their divisions to 30 or fewer and essentially abandon the ground war in Europe. But now with the arrival of fresh troop numbers with the Americans, there is a fighting chance for the Allies. And in the summer of 1918, German attacks in the war had halted. And up and down the Western Front, the initiative depends on the readiness of the Allies, who, for the first time in a long time, have more soldiers and weapons and material than the Germans. So even though the Germans are halted, the Allies behind the scenes are in a desperate situation, too. And nothing is clear, nothing is obvious, even at this point in the war, even years into it. So with all that set up, take it away, James. What's going to happen with the 100 Days Offensives?
All right. So the Allies, of course, that refers to Britain, France, and the Americans, although the Americans technically didn't consider themselves allies, you know, Wilson was too good for that. We're going to be an associated power. But they're ready to turn the tables now. As Scott mentioned before, the Germans took one last gamble, one last roll of the dice, tried to just punch through and reach Paris, and it just, you know, it just petered out. It started out well, and eventually just it was stopped. It died. Isn't that the story of this war, Scott? How many times have we said that we should go back at the beginning and and record a little thing where we say that's the drinking game. Every time we say that, we talk about a battle that got off to a good start and then eventually petered out. But anyway, so the Germans failed, as Scott said, and now the Allies are hoping to turn the tables and push the Germans back and possibly even go into Germany itself. So we're going to talk about a smaller battle here, relatively small, called the Battle of Amiens. The supreme commander of the British Army in Europe, General Haig, or Marshal Haig, I should say, Field Marshal, that's the equivalent of a five-star general in the U.S. Army. But Haig and his subordinate General Rawlinson wanted to conduct a series of small surprise attacks on the Germans up and down the front. You know, the idea is hit them everywhere at once, and somewhere they will collapse. So at 4:20 a.m., oh, that's too early for me. Goodness, I could never be a soldier because they do everything so doggone early. But at 4:20 a.m. on August 8th, a combined British, Australian, and Canadian force attacked and overran the German front line and advanced 10 miles by noon. And wow. If you've been, yeah, that's a lot for World War One. The effect was so severe on the Germans that the supreme German commander, basically de facto supreme commander, Erich Ludendorff, said that this was the black day of the German army. Ludendorff, we're going to see, he's starting to kind of unravel a little bit. He's coming apart and he's not really fit for command, but I mean, who else are they going to get? So the German forces retreated. And now we start to see German soldiers that are refusing to obey orders to stand and fight. They're ordered stand and fight. And they say, nope, we're out of here. Many of them even surrendered. Before long, however, they did rally and they counterattacked. Ludendorff wrote this. He said, "We cannot win this war anymore, but we must not lose it." And he offered his resignation to his boss, Paul von Hindenburg, but Hindenburg rejected it. This battle ended on the 12th. Wow, Scott, look at that, a four-day battle.
Wow, not a year-long battle.
That's like a five-minute battle in the Civil War or something. But anyway, the British reached the German defenses and were stopped. The Allies took 44,000 casualties. The Germans lost 70,000 casualties, plus another 28,000 prisoners. So we're starting to see a lot of German prisoners being taken. They're just, a lot of the German soldiers are done. That's it. We'd rather just be a prisoner. At least we'll get fed properly. Because remember, everybody has to keep in mind that the German army was way underfed, especially compared to the British and the Americans and the French.
Yep, it's all turnips thanks to that blockade.
Yeah, turnips get old after a while. They would get old for me after one bite. Anyway, all right, so shall we go on into the late summer?
Let's do it.
All right, so on August 20th, the French attacked between Soissons and Compiègne. They drove the Germans back, and Ludendorff called this the second black day for the German army. So how many more of these black days can they take? But I will say this, they are not done. Germans, this is not a chess game. They're not going to resign from the game. You know, Germans, they fight very tenaciously, whether it's offense or defense, but especially on defense. On the 21st, the British and some New Zealanders, supported by 156 tanks, attacked the German lines, taking again several thousand prisoners. Then the British and French attacked along the Somme. This is sometimes called the Battle of Albert or Bapaume. Sorry if I mispronounced that. And they took all the positions that they had fought over in 1916. Making some progress. On the 26th, the British captured Delville Wood in the Battle of the Scarpe. On the 30th, the French pushed the Germans back across the River Ain. That same day, the Americans captured Juvigny. So to summarize, in 11 days, the Allies captured another 10 miles of ground, and they pushed the Germans back in Flanders. Flanders, of course, as we've seen before, is the far northern part of the line up against the coast. The Allied commanders planned further attacks in late September, and the British would attack eastward against the center of the Hindenburg Line. The French and the Americans would attack northward across the River Meuse, and the British and Belgians in Flanders. Nice to see the Belgians getting on board here. They're out for some major revenge here.
Yeah, they've been, I think, occupied for a long time. And
yeah,
we saw them in the beginning of the war, not too much throughout, but we're going to see them appear here at the end.
Yeah, they are highly motivated, shall we say. In late August, Ludendorff ordered the entire German line back to the Hindenburg line. From then on, he was adopting a purely defensive strategy. So no more attacks for the Germans, just going to try to hold the line. By the end of August, the Germans had taken 228,000 casualties, 110,000 of whom had probably deserted. A lot of German soldiers are just heading for the hills or the woods, just disappearing. And they only received 130,000 replacements. So the German army is starting to crack, Scott. They're a lot of them are just flat out done, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're losing it in a way. I mean, they're finally being pushed on a defensive. And it's interesting now when you were describing those steps of the battle that we're seeing major movement here. Just to update what we had mentioned over the last several episodes, because some of these facts can get lost in all the information here, that finally armies are adapting to the realities of World War One. They're doing different things. They're not just doing the artillery barrage and then running for it, which will be, I think, part of our drinking game. And I'll go back and record some kind of prequel episode. Artillery barrage, men run for it. They get shot down. They retreat. They don't gain anything, and back and forth.
Well, the listeners are going to end up under the table, Scott. That happens so often.
Yeah, until very, very, very far into the war, that is the standard. And evolution doesn't really happen until, I think, Passchendaele and other fights.
Yeah, I would agree. You start to see the coordinated assaults where all the components are working together.
Right, you see the combined arms assault, and paratroopers weren't a part of World War One, but at this stage, there were plans being drawn out to use paratroopers to have an even more effective combined arms assault. The war ends before this becomes a reality, but if listeners are curious about that, in early 2020, I released an episode, I think it's called Death from Above, about the origin of paratroopers and their role in combined arms assault, and some of the plans, at least, to use them into World War One that never came to fruition. But this is just part of the general evolution that is happening. It's making it possible to take 10 miles in a day when in the past you'd have 2 miles taken after months of battle. Something I want to mention, with the battle of, Saint-Mihiel, where the American Expeditionary Force gets involved. I just want to mention something about them and their, number of soldiers and what it means to have them infused into the Allied coalition when it's in danger of crumbling because of the depletion of manpower. There were 1.2 million men under arms in France, and 60,000 were arriving every week. This was what Germany feared and what caused them to launch a desperate spring offensive, because they knew that soon they would be outnumbered. This is what gave the opportunity for the Allies to go on the offensive, not just to halt Ludendorff on the Marne, but to drive Germans back, perhaps even behind the Rhine. This was giving them hope for a final victory. The assignment given to the Americans was to attack the German salient at Saint-Mihiel. Is that correct?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Okay.
I don't know. Sorry, French speakers.
Saint-Mihiel. James and I talked about how we love you French speakers or those who love the French language, but sometimes you're a little bit more critical than speakers of other languages. So, you know, just...
Yeah.
Give us a little bit of a wide berth.
A little bit of grace and mercy.
Okay. So the idea was to attack the German salient on the Meuse River south of Verdun, and they would go into action led by Pershing in a newly configured United States First Army. But Pershing wanted to do more. He didn't just want to reduce the salient. He wanted to liberate Metz. It was a French city that was about 40 miles east of there. And this would put the American Expeditionary Force in a position to threaten the industrial heart of Germany in Saarland. So they are poised and ready to attack. And with that, let's look at the Battle of Saint-Mihiel. What's going on there?
All right. Well, we'll start out by saying, you kind of implied this or touched on it, but this is the first battle planned and conducted by an American army with its own commander. It had taken the American Expeditionary Force quite some time to get all the guys over, to get all the supplies in place and everything organized. And they did a terrific job. They did it as quickly as they could, but it just takes time to go from nothing to 1.2 million. And Pershing, as we've talked about before, and we've seen, Pershing had to constantly resist attempts by the British and French commanders, especially the French, to divvy up the Americans and just plug them into some of these units that Scott talked about earlier who were being decimated. They were cut down from 4 regiments to 3 regiments and things like that. The French wanted the Americans to just join their lines, join their ranks. And Pershing and his superiors said, no, we're going to be in a separate, distinct American army. And now he's finally got that in place. The American First Army, Scott and I, you'll love this, Scott. I love this too. Espionage is one of our favorite things, but or you know, deception. I like this. The American First Army. One of their, I forget exactly if he was a colonel or who he was. He wasn't like a super. It wasn't Pershing or one of his corps commanders or anything. But an American officer wrote out some fake orders, and he used a carbon sheet to make a carbon copy of them. So he took the carbon copy. He was staying in a hotel. He took the and he knew there were going to be German spies in this hotel. It was a French hotel, but there were German spies. And so he took the carbon copy, wadded it up, threw it in the wastebasket in his hotel room, and then checked out. And then later, sure enough, one of the housekeepers who was a German spy found this wadded up piece of carbon paper in the trash. And so eventually, of course, this piece of carbon paper found its way into the German Army's headquarters, and look, it's like McClellan, you know, before Antietam, except no cigars. It's like we've got the American orders. We know exactly what they were going to do, and so the Germans reacted to that and positioned their troops accordingly. Problem is, that was exactly not what the Americans were going to do. It was totally fake. So
he exploited the German fetish for documents and bureaucracy and paper orders, and which still exists strongly in Germany today. They love documentation, and they exploited it.
Yeah, so I love that. I just think that's great. Sent them false orders. The order said that the attack was going to occur at Mulhouse, but the real attack was, as we've seen, St. Mihiel at the salient. To prepare for the attack, 3,000 big guns and 40,000 tons, not 40,000 pounds, 40,000 tons of ammunition were assembled. 15 miles of road were built using 100,000 tons of crushed stone. I want to give it all its glory there. I don't want to understate it. 250 miles of light gauge rail and 45 miles of standard gauge railways were built. So this is massive. Reminds you of what the Germans had done before their spring offensive, or the Kaiserschlacht. I just have to throw in a German word from time to time. It's fun. That would be another good drinking game thing. Like anytime I use a German word, there's so many things, but it's just taken us the whole series to figure it out.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
So, you know, massive assault being prepared with all these preparations, roads being built, rail lines. And then on September 12th, the attack began. 200,000 Americans and 48,000 French attacked along a 12-mile front in the pouring rain. The Americans fired off thousands of shells of phosgene gas, and the Allies had 1,400 planes in the sky.
All right, this is a serious air war at this point.
Yeah, we're getting to where it's not quite World War II air combat yet, not even close, but it's moving in that direction for sure. We're a heck of a lot further along than we were in 1914, 1915. The Allies had a 3-to-1 advantage in infantry. 3-to-1, that's amazing. If you're playing Risk, you'll take those odds, right? 5-to-1 in artillery, 7-to-1 with aircraft, and they had nearly 300 tanks. Needless to say, the Germans were overwhelmed. They quickly retreated. The Allies suffered about 7,000 casualties, while the Germans suffered 17,000, which is, you know, more than 2-to-1. And 13,000 of those were prisoners. Again, we see the Germans surrendering in by the thousands. The Allies took 200 square miles of territory. That's just mind-boggling. And several towns, including San Mihiel itself. So the war, once again, had truly become a war of movement. We saw a lot of movement during the German spring offenses, but that was ground to a halt, as we saw. Now there's a war of movement in the opposite direction.
Right. And one other thing just before we wrap this up, because it seems like the avalanche is starting and it's irrevocable movement. But even at this point, even in the late summer, early fall of 1918, there are times when the Allies still get stalled. After some of these rousing successes, the British and French offensives get stalled where they're fighting. Haig suffered 500,000 casualties in 1918, and so did the French. What they tried to do was breach the Hindenburg line and didn't have much left for the Meuse or the Rhine lines where the Germans stood. Lloyd George's war cabinet warned Haig that the shrinking army he was conducting slowly eastward was Britain's last army, and it was going fast. So as the fall and the winter are approaching, everything hinges on the American thrust forward from St. Michel that we looked at in Verdun towards Sedan. And the main core of the British or the German army west of the Rhine. So it really is looking good here, but if it had failed, the British and the French were almost gone here. So it was a last effort on their part. So I just want to point that out here as we're moving along into the fall.
Right. Yeah. We've seen thousands upon thousands of Germans surrendering, but there's still many hundreds of thousands that have not surrendered. So, yep. As the great philosopher Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over.
Yep. Especially this war.
Yes. All right. So we're going to move into the fall now. Since August 18th, the British Army had advanced more than 25 miles on a front of 40 miles. Just to see how much this is, we're going to compare it to the Somme in 1916, where they advanced less than 10 miles on a front of only 20 miles in 4.5 months.
Wow.
So, yeah, this is like turbo warfare compared to what we're used to in World War I. September 18th, the Allies overran the outer works of the Hindenburg Line. On September 26th, French forces attacked and drove the Germans back, advancing several miles. So it's a real team effort, wouldn't you say, Scott? We've got British pushing the Germans back, French pushing them back, and Americans. It's kind of like three against one now. It's not really fair.
Yeah, it's got to feel incredible if for soldiers who had been veterans of the Battle of the Somme to be moving so quickly if you're fighting for the Allies. That must have felt incredible.
Yes, like a different war almost. The next week, or the same week rather, the British attacked the center of the Hindenburg Line. The Germans did fight this off. The Hindenburg Line, as we've talked about in the past, is an amazingly strong defensive position. But from July 15th to September 30th, the Allies took nearly 250,000 prisoners on the Western Front alone. When I say that means German prisoners. So 250,000 Germans surrendered in the summer and early fall of 1918. September 28th, the British launched another offensive, sometimes called the Fifth Battle of Ypres. So it's just not right if we don't have at least, four or five battles in each location. With Belgian support, they pushed the Germans back until bad weather forced them to halt. Another attack on the 29th by the Americans broke an eight-mile stretch of the second part of the Hindenburg Line. So now only the German third line of defense remained intact. So even the Hindenburg Line is not completely impenetrable. Over the next few days, the Allies continued pushing the Germans back. On September 28th, Ludendorff told Hindenburg they had to seek an armistice. They both told the Kaiser this. But President Wilson refused to negotiate with the Kaiser. The Kaiser signed a proclamation establishing a parliamentary regime, and Ludendorff, in frustration, said, "We cannot fight against the whole world." It must have felt like that, Scott, the whole world. You know, as we've seen British, French, Americans all making major breakthroughs, the Germans are getting pretty depressed at this point, the leadership.
Right. Their allies have either switched sides or ceased to exist or were never that much of a support in the beginning, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I think the most they can hope for is to fight a war of attrition that's so costly and so miserable for the Allies that they could seek a peace that would be most advantageous to them, which maybe after the spring offensives, they would be in a better position to do that. But every day they're in a worse and worse position, and their negotiating strength and the hand of cards they hold, or whatever analogy you want to use, is getting worse and worse.
Absolutely. All right. Well, now that leads us up to probably the most iconic, epic, and major battle in which the Americans were involved, the famous Meuse-Argonne offensive. This is going to last a long time, several weeks. starts on September 26th, and it's going to go right up till November 11th. Why November 11th, you ask? Ah, you'll just have to wait. We're going to keep you in suspense. So have a seat. Have your favorite type of liquor ready. Here we go. On September, this is an epic one. I love this battle. September 26th, American forces launched the Meuse Argonne offensive, which with an enormous, can you guess, how'd they start it?
Aerial bombardment. Submarine attack. It's a submarine attack. What is it?
Submarine attack. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, they snuck a submarine into the Rhine River, which is actually too far away, but. An artillery barrage.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Right, folks.
Okay.
You guessed it. How did we know? Wow. Yes. And get this. In 4 hours, they fired more artillery shells than the Union Army fired in the entire Civil War. I mean, we're just pouring it on. Then they went over the top. So kind of like that old school style of attack we were talking about, the Americans, sometimes the Americans come in for criticism, and Pershing in particular, the charge is leveled that they just didn't really learn what the British and the French had learned through years of experience and just said, well, we're going to do it our way. We're going to do things the way they've always been done. And as a result, they lost a lot of casualties that perhaps they didn't need to lose. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly one criticism that you hear. Let's just go back to the old system of artillery barrage and then infantry charging across no man's land and all that. So we'll see what happens. All right. The infantry attacked. They had the Argonne Forest, very thick, dense forest on their left, and the Meuse River on their right. They initially pushed the Germans back, but then they were soon stopped due to logistical issues and stiff resistance by the Germans, another theme we've seen again and again. Early in the offensive, this is a neat little vignette, there was a battalion of about 500 Americans commanded by Major Charles Whittlesey. They were cut off from their main force, and they became surrounded by Germans. They ran out of food and were hit by artillery, both German and American. So they were being shelled by their own people because the Americans didn't know they were in the location they were at. So the communication, don't you love World War I communication, Scott? They sent a carrier pigeon, to the Americans, asking them to stop shelling. Would you please stop shelling us? We're on your side. German flamethrowers attacked, but the Americans fought them off. The American high command thought the situation was hopeless and that the battalion was lost. The Germans withdrew on October 7th, and the surviving members of the so-called Lost Battalion rejoined the American force. I think there was a book written about this, the Lost Battalion. There's definitely a movie, and we need to put this on the list I made for you, Scott. I forgot this one, but there's a made-for-TV around the year 2000 or so. A pretty good movie I watched a while back. Stars Rick Schroeder as Major Whittlesey. Pretty good show. We need to add that to the list. But anyway, neat little story about these guys' heroism and their failure to give up, even though they're surrounded and being shelled by their own guys as well as the Germans. All right. Shall we move on?
Let's do it.
In early October, Pershing decided not to attack the central German position, but instead to focus on the heights of the Argonne and the Meuse on the flanks. It would be helpful if listeners, if you can, to get a map on this, and I'm not going to try to even do a mental map on this. It's not that confusing, but again, a map will help you. Pershing was hoping to cut a key rail link, which brought the Germans supplies. And on October 14th, to be specific, the Americans did seize the high ground. They had achieved their objective set on September 16th. They had one more German position to take, but they were worn out. The Germans were just really putting up stiff resistance. So Pershing decided to pause the offensive for a while, and he gave up field command of the First Army and focused entirely on overall coordination of the offense. I should say that prior to this, originally you had just the American First Army, and then by the time they kept getting more and more reinforcements, and so Pershing created a Second Army. But Pershing himself originally commanded the First Army as well as being in overall command of the entire American force. And then he had another general who commanded the Second Army. But that's just really too much for one man to actually command the nuts and bolts of the actual army and then coordinate the overall plans of the entire American force. So he gave up First Army Command and just became the overall commander, you know, kind of an Eisenhower figure. Let's see. Where it was. Okay, so later during the offensive. Oh, yeah, here's a great story.
This is a great one, yeah. Listeners.
Another great little vignette, which also has a movie. I'll start it out, and then Scott's going to add some details. So there was a conscientious objector. I think he was from Tennessee. He was a Southern man. He was very devout Christian. He belonged to a denomination that was pacifistic. They didn't believe in fighting. His name was Alvin York, but he went to fight anyway. He was a corporal originally. Well, I guess he was a private originally, right? But by this time, he was a corporal. He and his men were given the task of clearing out a German machine gun nest. In their initial effort, 9 of his 17 men were wounded. And one of his men, by the way, had the last name of Early. I had to bring that out. I don't know. I don't think I'm related to him. But I think Early was either his sergeant or maybe a corporal. I can't remember. But anyway, the point is 9 of 17 men were wounded, so that's more than half. York told the other 7 who were not wounded to guard prisoners. And he went to the machine gun nest all by himself. He killed up to 28 Germans with his marksmanship. He had grown up hunting a lot and so was a very, very good shot. The Germans surrendered, and he returned to his men with 132 prisoners. He's one guy, Corporal York, is marching 132 Germans. And I think that speaks again to how demoralized the Germans were. It's like, man, let's go get some food and some sleep. He was promoted to sergeant and became an international celebrity. Scott, take it from there.
Yeah, I want to dig into the story more. And listeners, I know that for some of you, the way you learn history, you would prefer to learn via a biography rather than a, you know, thick military history tome told from the position of high command. And if you're more of a biographical learner, Alvin York is a great way to look at World War I if you care to look at things through the American perspective. But I want to dig into this a lot more and look at one particular account that describes how exactly he does what James described. And one man makes 132 prisoners surrender. Just if you imagine it, it doesn't make sense, but here's how it goes. So he's attacking the nest. At first, he's pinned to the ground and bullets are slicing dirt in front of them. And he guessed that there were 20 machine guns ahead of him. And occasionally he would see German heads over the barrels. So what he did is he treated the German heads popping over the barrels as old-fashioned target practice. So as machine gun bullets are whipping past him, gunners are unable to depress the barrels far enough to nail him to the ground. And so what's happening is his accurate shooting suppressed the German fire to the point that he could stand up and advance. And he did so. So as he's doing so, a German officer and 5 soldiers with fixed bayonets charge from about 25 yards. The magazine in York's rifle was down to its final rounds, so he flipped out his pistol, a Colt 45 automatic, and he shot the attackers as he would have shot wild turkeys, meaning that he hit the last one first and then worked his way up the line. And it worked because with wild turkeys, they didn't see their fellows getting blasted, and the same thing happened with the Germans. They would just keep going and wouldn't scatter. He thought that if he shot the lead man, the others would fall to the prone position and then pick him off, but because he shot them in this method, they didn't, and he went in succession. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Then he advanced again with his rifle and shouted at the machine gunners to surrender. He figured he had them now because between foiling the bayonet charge and knocking bullets into German heads, he'd killed about 20 men. So here's how the exchange happened. The German officer in command, Lieutenant Paul Jürgen Vollmer, emptied his pistol at the advancing Tennessean. Every shot missed, and he, I guess, became completely demoralized, and he shouted, "English! No, not English. What? American. Good Lord, if you won't shoot anymore, I will make them give up." So,
that's funny.
Yeah, I guess he figured at this point, all right, I'm done. Nothing else to do here. Yeah, so that's a story there. He just went right up. He kept shooting, and I guess they figured, all right, we have nothing else to do here. If maybe they were awestruck if one man is charging their nest and taking out 20 men. They had finally decided to give up. We don't know what was going through their heads. But it's an amazing story. And like James said, he became an international celebrity after this point. So what happens next after the rest of the battle?
All right. So, yeah, that's a great story. Thanks for filling that in. And of course, there's the famous 1941 movie, Sergeant York, starring Gary Cooper. I don't know how accurate that movie is. I saw it a long time ago, like when I was in high school. But it's fun if you want to check that movie out. Well, another interesting thing is that is little known, and I did not know this, Scott, until I was researching for this episode, but the U.S. Army during World War I used Choctaw Indians to transmit messages. German wiretappers were completely unable to understand them, and they began to be taken by surprise. It's more famous, the World War II story of how the U.S. used the Navajo code talkers, and there's a movie about that, of course. But these are not quite as famous, but I think that's really cool. They just, to transmit messages, the Choctaw just spoke to each other in their own language. And the Germans were like, what the heck is this? What? We do not understand this code at all. So that was a really interesting thing that I learned in preparing for this series. All right, coming to November now. We saw how in mid-October Pershing had paused the American attack on the Germans. But now on November 1, he starts it up again. The Americans began a new offensive at the Meuse River. They had three artillery batteries made from 14-inch naval guns. These are massive, massive artillery pieces. They also used 41 tons of mustard gas and many aircraft. They completely broke through the German lines. In the confusion of the battle, this is a great story too. There was one brigade commander, an American brigade commander, who was taken prisoner by American forces. They thought he was a German general. It's like, no, I'm not German. I promise you. Yeah. But no, he didn't even speak German. And this is, of course, General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur is just a fascinating, one of the great, most colorful characters in all American history, and especially in military history. You know, sometimes generals are just kind of dry, boring people, but not MacArthur. He would charge into battle with no gun, and he wouldn't even wear a helmet, and he was just like a swashbuckler from a bygone era. But MacArthur rose up through the ranks very quickly. He was twice wounded, twice gassed, and decorated 13 times, and he was cited 7 more times for bravery in World War I. The Secretary of War, Newton Baker, called him the bravest frontline general in France. And at 38, he became the youngest U.S. Army general in the war. And that's pretty incredible for World War I, when we've talked about how a lot of the generals are in their 60s, 70s even. Pershing, I think, was 57, 58. This is just a young whippersnapper general.
Right. And when he's accidentally taken prisoner, I pity whoever it was who did that to him. Because MacArthur, I mean, he is truly a giant of 20th century American history, general in World War II, overall commander in the Korean War. And in his lifetime, he saw himself as a world historical figure and a statesman. So to accidentally capture someone like that, I wonder what happened to those soldiers. Were they forced to stand on planks and have their head shaved and do a medieval shaming because of that?
I don't know. I haven't seen that part of the story.
Yeah, that's about the worst person you could do that to, MacArthur, except for Patton, maybe.
Yeah, then you'd get slapped. I know. But I don't think these guys got slapped, but I don't know, I'll have to look that up, or maybe one of our listeners can and let us know. But
yeah, he had a healthy opinion of himself, MacArthur. Great man of history, and he thought equally high of himself.
Yes. All right, so by the end of the offensive, which lasted 47 days, and there's a great book about it by that title, 47 Days. Scott and I have a list of books and movies and other resources, and you can check that out if you want. The Americans had lost 550 killed and over 1,500 wounded per day on average. Let me say that again. On average, for 47 days, the Americans lost 550 dead and 1,500 wounded per day. It was and remains the largest and bloodiest battle that the U.S. has ever been involved in. I totaled it up, Scott. It's a total of over 25,000 killed and 70,000 wounded. So, again, the French and Germans and British would say, that's nothing. That's
battle.
One day for us. But when you think about the Somme, on day one, the British lost 20,000 dead and 40,000 wounded. But still, given how late the Americans joined the war and how relatively small their army was compared to those of the other nations, that's a lot. One other thing I want to mention, I want to give kudos to, there were about 380,000 African Americans who served in the AEF. We mentioned them before, but I want to mention them again. There were 42,000 in combat units, but most were employed as laborers. And that's really sad because they wanted to fight. I'm sure almost every single one of the black soldiers that came over wanted to be in the thick of the battle, but due to racism and discrimination at the time, 42,000 out of 380,000 got to fight. The
is
rest
this when Wilson resegregated the military? Is this after that? If I have my timeline right?
Well, he didn't really resegregate the military. The military had always been segregated. He resegregated the White House. That may be what you're thinking of.
Oh, okay.
Prior to Wilson, blacks and whites worked side by side. Like, you know, for example, under the Taft administration, Roosevelt. But yeah, he resegregated the White House and the government employees, but not necessarily the military. And if you think about that, so that's 340,000 black soldiers who had to work as stevedores and just general, you know, I don't know what, maybe repairmen, but mainly just laborers. So, but nevertheless, 42,000 did get into combat. They served in fully segregated units with mostly white officers, although some junior officers were black. There were black lieutenants and captains, unlike what had been the case in the Civil War. There was one particular division that was really rewarded, I guess, or honored for their fighting, the all-black 93rd Division. They fought alongside the French with great distinction. Many received the Croix de Guerre, which is the highest French award. One unit called the Harlem Hellfighters became famous for its bravery and the high number of casualties they took. And overall, in the war, 5,000 African-American soldiers were wounded and 750 were killed in France. Sadly, when they went back to the U.S., they were not going to be at all recognized or rewarded for their service. And in fact, they're going to be treated equally as bad, if not worse, than they had been before the war.
Right. And for those who know the story of the civil rights movement and what's happening in the early 20th century, this and World War II are important moments where these black servicemen who are fighting and dying are doing so. But then they're also going to places like France where they're receiving infinitely better treatment. They're not treated exactly like white people. I'm not saying that, but whatever prejudice they face is more of kind of like the innocent prejudice, if I can say such a thing. It's not Jim Crow segregation. It's somebody making a comment here or there. So when they see this alternate reality where, oh, I could be treated equally, I could receive the full privileges of citizenship, I'm not forced to sit in a different place, I can dine at any restaurant I want to. Maybe my command structure is treating me with prejudice, but this foreign nation isn't doing so whatsoever, and I'm receiving the full military honors that white soldiers are. So this is a critical point, this in World War II, that adds a lot of momentum to the civil rights movement decades later.
Yes, this and especially World War II, but that's another story. All right, so moving on, we're coming up to the end now. In October, the Allies made gains at several places along the front. They overran the last part of the Hindenburg Line. The Germans retreated from October 9th through the 11th to the Hermann position, which is another defensive position behind the Hindenburg Line. But their heavy artillery stopped the Allied advance. On the 14th, King Albert of Belgium led an attack personally on German forces in Flanders. He was supported by American bombers. In 4 days, they advanced nearly 20 miles. Another impressive feat. Took 12,000 prisoners, and they captured 550 big guns. The German Navy retreated from Belgian ports and the Allies nearly reached the Dutch border. By the 19th, the entire Belgian coast was in Allied hands. Better late than never, right, Scott? I guess. On the 17th, the Allies attacked the Hermann position. They were supported by 1,300 heavy guns. The infantry attack pushed the Germans back some more. And then on October 26th, Ludendorff was removed from his position as quartermaster general. So how the mighty have fallen. Ludendorff, who'd basically been in charge of the German army for a couple years and for all practical purposes in charge of the government. The Kaiser had really devolved into pretty much a figurehead by this point who just did whatever the army told him to do. But Ludendorff is gone now, and he's so unpopular in Germany that when his resignation was announced in movie houses, people cheered. Yay! Ludendorff, fearing for his own safety, fled in disguise to Sweden. So he's not only fired, but he's gone completely out of there. On November 4 and 5, the British and French forces made further gains. Despite the Allies' successes, of course, they took large number of casualties. The Germans fought tooth and nail up to the very end. And the German Navy went into mutiny. One of the German naval commanders proposed, let's just do a final, no guts, no glory, final charge, and try to see if we can inflict some damage on the British Navy. But the sailors said, nope, we're done. We're not going to do it. They went into mutiny. Unrest broke out all across Germany. A German delegation met with Marshal Foch, the French commander who was overall Allied commander at this point, and also other Allied leaders in Compiègne on the 9th. And early on November 11th, they agreed to an armistice that would go into effect at 11 o'clock in the morning on that day. It was the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month. Kaiser Wilhelm, by the way, he was visiting Spa. He was advised that he had no real control over much of the army. While there, he received a telegram from Berlin that read, all troops deserted, completely out of hand. Wilhelm wasn't stupid. He decided the best thing to do was to also bug out, a la Ludendorff, although he went to the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands on November 9th, Kaiser Wilhelm II formally abdicated, and that is the end of the German Empire, the Second Reich. And then at 11 a.m., both sides fought right up until the hour of the armistice. But 11 a.m., there was silence, followed by the roar of men cheering. You read people who were there at the time writing about it, and they talk about just how deafening the cheering was. The fighting was over. Men from both sides came out of their trenches and embraced. And Scott, you're going to bring us home.
Right. And let's really pause at this moment, because this is after 4 years of the worst warfare, and I say that definitively, that the world had ever seen, perhaps ever since then. I don't know since then, but before then, it's absolutely clear. War on an industrial scale. Millions had died from shrapnel, from disease, had suffered total mental collapse, absolutely hellish. And I was looking for accounts or quotes or perspectives on what it felt to be there and actually feel the moment of peace. There's famous poems, or like In Flanders Field. You can find those all over the place. But I was thinking back to something I had read many years before that had still stuck with me today. And of all people, this is a quote that comes from Kurt Vonnegut, who was an American novelist, a World War II vet. He wrote a bunch of books in the 20th century, like Slaughterhouse-Five, famously very anti-war. Slaughterhouse-Five is about the firebombing of the German city of Dresden. He had, throughout his life, spoke out against the Vietnam War, spoke out against the Gulf War. So not the first person I would think, but here's what he says when describing this moment of silence. He said, when I was a boy, all the people of all the nations who had fought in the First World War were silent during the 11th minute of the 11th hour of Armistice Day, which was the 11th day of the 11th month. It was during that minute in 1918 that millions upon millions of human beings stopped butchering one another. I have talked to old men who were on battlefields during that minute. They have told me in one way or another that the sudden silence was the voice of God. So we still have among us some men who can remember when God spoke clearly to mankind. Armistice Day has become Veterans Day. Armistice Day was sacred. Veterans Day is not. So I will throw Veterans Day over my shoulder. Armistice Day I will keep. I don't want to throw away sacred things. So I think that's a really powerful reflection of what it means to feel peace for the first time after war and think that this hell that we've been living in, there can be an end to it and we can go to better things. Well, that's the end of the war, but with such a big war, tidying it up and deciding what to do next can be just as big. And what happens after is equally important because the legacy is so far-reaching and even impacts us today. So in the next few episodes, we're going to be looking not just what happens to the figures here in World War One, the generals, the captains, other officers, the emperors, the heads of state. We're also going to be seeing what happens with the peace and how that affects the rest of the 20th century and even up to the 21st century. There we go. That wraps up everything for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War One for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.